gentlemen, and welcome to the first live stream recording of the Cultures of America podcast. I'm Dr. Ali H. Akhtar, and you can follow the show on YouTube and Instagram by searching the hashtag Cultures of America. You can also follow us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts for the audio version. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Prof. Ali Akhtar, P-R-O-F-A-L-I-A-K-H-T-A-R. I'm freezing, and it's supposed to be summer here on the East Coast, but I guess it's not, and so I'm surviving. Brought out my gloves again. I want to get right into some of the most interesting aspects of American cultural history that I think have really shaped the modern world and the way we talk about questions of like culture, race, gender, class, and all of that. And I want to talk in particular about the history of immigration. Now, immigration in American history has always been a kind of interesting moving target of sorts. There were decades in the late 1800s when the United States government and the American people, or at least communities in America, were very in favor of immigration. There were decades in the early 1900s when people were against it, and whether they were in favor or against it, there were always different opinions about who should come, how many people should come, and where should they come from. One of the biggest questions was whether immigration should be limited to places in Europe. So one of the biggest questions in American history was whether immigrants should be allowed to come from non-European regions. And in the late 1800s, you began to see in American history restrictions on immigration from parts of Asia. So that wasn't only East Asia, what we think of now is Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, China, Japan, Southeast Asia, but that also included South Asia. And so in the late 1800s, a lot of immigrants came from Europe and the Middle East. At the time, Europe and the Middle East were partly connected in terms of political empires because the Ottoman Empire, up until 1923, included parts of the Middle East and parts of Europe. So Yugoslavia, next to Greece, Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, the former Yugoslavia, those regions were connected to Turkey, and Turkey was connected to Syria and Lebanon, and all that was the Ottoman world. And the American government policymakers basically saw that region as part of the historical Caucasian regions of the world, in contrast with the African regions of the world, and in contrast with the Asian or Asiatic regions of the world. So the outcome was that in the late 1800s, people were coming to the United States, and as the government was trying to have a more formal immigration policy, the rules allowed a lot of European and Southern European and Middle Eastern peoples to come to the United States. And this included everything from Italians and the Irish, to the French, to the Lebanese people who are now Lebanese and Syrian, what are now the Lebanese, Syrian, Palestinian regions, and also Turkish peoples. And this includes also Muslims and non-Muslims. So these were Armenian Orthodox Christians of places like Istanbul in the late 1800s, Syrian, Lebanese, Palestinian regions today, Christians who were from those regions, Muslims, and those people came in large numbers in the late 1800s at a time when the United States was just beginning to industrialize. So this was the time when the British, the United States, formerly part of the British Empire up until the late 1700s, the British, the Americans in the late 1800s were all trying to fast forward the production of the construction of factories to mass produce things like garments, by World War I, mass producing the kinds of technologies that were used in war, so the kind of early military industries. And the labor for a lot of those factories came from not only international places like Europe and the Middle East, but also places like the United States itself. So there was a kind of parallel immigration, but really more migration from the southern states of the United States at a time when abolition was at its peak, the abolitionist movement, stretching from in its heyday, the early mid-1800s to the late 1800s, saw the rise of a large number of people of African heritage who were people from the Caribbean, older families in the United States in the 1800s, newer arrivals from West Africa as late as the mid-1800s, some of whom were Muslims, who by the late 1800s were officially declared free as part of the Emancipation Proclamation and a lot of the laws that developed in the 1800s, who were together with a lot of older African heritage Americans, who included business people in the mid-1800s, politicians, some of whom, so these were the larger group of what they called at the time freedmen. This includes people like Frederick Douglass. There were also other D.C.-based African-American politicians in the mid-1800s who were part of this larger group that by the late 1800s, many segments of these populations had already moved northward. Individual politicians, individual business people in the mid-1800s. But with the abolition of slavery, this very much larger group of Americans now began to move from the South northward. And this was the whole story of the Great Migration northward that in African American history and in American history we talk about as something that really kind of peaked in the 1900s, but that had its earliest origins in the late 1800s. And so what you see in the late 1800s is this mix of peoples in northern cities like Chicago and New York at a time when factories are being built of new arrivals from the southern states who are of African heritage. This is part of African American history, migration northward, business people, former slaves, politicians. And then you see a lot of immigrants from abroad, Italy, Ireland, Ottoman Syria, even Egypt. And by the late 1800s, you also have some segments of the American population who are of Chinese heritage. So at the time, the British Empire had taken the unprecedented move of invading the coast of China and Japan and forcing the Qing Dynasty of China to open its ports to international trade on certain kind of trade terms. The goal of the British was not to conquer China, but rather to secure, in competition with the French and other groups like the rising American Navy, the British were trying to secure particular favorable trade deals that would allow the British to pour onto the Chinese market a lot of these new factory industrialized goods like garments and whatnot that the British wanted to pour onto the markets in the Middle East and China without having high tariffs and make a lot of money off of that. Part of the British strategy there was to turn some of these regions into producers of cash crops. So Egypt, once a place that used to produce a lot of finished textiles for Europeans and other parts of the world, by the 1800s is a major cotton producer, sending cotton over to Europe, where the Europeans would then, in their factories, begin to now send a lot of these finished textiles back to the Middle East. And so the same thing's happening in China, where the British want this new market for British goods in China. And so by the late 1800s, as part of this kind of British policy of trying to be a little bit more aggressive with China, part of a series of tensions that began especially with conflicts over access to tea, the British wanted larger volumes of Chinese tea for the British Empire and the European markets. The British eventually managed to kind of bypass the Chinese market by learning how to cultivate tea and bringing it over to South Asia, where the British East India Company, a private company with close connections with the British Crown, managed to bring tea cultivation to South Asia. The British Crown by the late 1800s had nationalized the British East India Company and nationalized the company's holdings. It was a militarized company that included parts of South Asia. And so now the British Crown was now, the empire and monarchy were now able to have their own access to their own tea based in South Asia as they now, just like in Egypt, managed to transform large parts of South Asia into more agricultural regions that would produce a cash crop, in this case not cotton but tea. And so the outcome of all that is, when the British did capture some of these ports, which included Hong Kong, which the British held on to all the way up until the late 1900s, so recently, I guess it's the 1990s, I think, the American government was on the receiving end of a lot of Chinese workers who were basically transferred over from China westward at the end of what came to be known as the Opium Wars. They were called the Opium Wars because before the British were able to now cultivate their own tea in India, they were pouring onto the Chinese market illegally opium, kind of a narcotic related to heroin, and this way they would get on the black market Chinese tea and be able to sell it for a high price over in England and Europe, where Europeans since the 1600s had developed a taste for Chinese black and Chinese green tea, in parallel with the growing British European taste for Turkish and Arabic coffee. There's a long history of European powers kind of being a little bit enterprising and learning how to cultivate their own varieties of these things, so they could have direct access to their own sources. So the Dutch brought East African and Middle Eastern coffee to Indonesia, and this is where you get like Sumatra coffee and the term Java for coffee. So the outcome of all this is that by the late 1800s, you have Chinese people who are in America. You have people of African descent who are in the United States, you know, West African born Muslims who are enslaved and were living as slaves in the United States. Older African heritage peoples, Christians, people who are from the Caribbean. There was an abolition of slavery earlier in the British Caribbean, Jamaica, Barbados, and all these places. And all these people are now starting to kind of live in the same cities and play in parts of like places like Chicago, New York. And this is where you begin to see some of the debates and tensions about the rapid demographic change of the United States in the late 1800s, particularly in, surprisingly, among the Northerners, who historically we look back at as the kind of, we think of as the more open-minded or multicultural peoples of American history. But in fact, a lot of that kind of pro-abolition, pro-multiculturalism, pro-diversity language was it existed in parallel with fears about their own kind of change of their own lifestyles in the North. You know, British heritage Americans and Dutch heritage Americans, there were some concerns there as a lot of immigrants came into these northern cities. And so this is where when you do go to certain places today, like New York, places like Harlem, there are districts like Hamilton Heights where you can see that there was once this kind of British American history there. Alexander Hamilton's house is right in the heart of Harlem, close to City College. And you can see that in the story of people like Alexander Russell Webb, who was a British heritage American diplomat who lived in the Hudson Valley, and who also ended up, I believe he spent some time in New York. The profiles of these people points to that kind of British and Dutch and European heritage of Americans in northern cities. And so the outcome is that one of the, when you look at the kind of moving target of immigration in America, it actually offers a little bit of an interesting window into how different groups came to the United States and what the debates were about their arrival. And so you have in the late 1800s, I think it was called, I can't remember if it was the Asian Exclusion Act or the Chinese Exclusion Act, and I should know this, but there were particular exclusions in the immigration laws that on the one hand formalized a process of immigration in the late 1800s, and that these laws also formalized a process of excluding Asian immigration. So the outcome was that in the late 1800s, up until World War I, you have decades and generations of immigrants coming in from what are really quite diverse parts of the world in the name of Caucasian immigration, white immigration, legally white immigration. And so these are the Syrian Muslims, Ottoman Syrian Muslims, Syrian Christians, Armenian Orthodox. And it was so kind of internally diverse that that there's some research on how people could kind of pass as one of the other groups. So Muslims from what is now Turkey could pass as Armenian Christians. And this is where you ended up seeing a kind of mix of peoples who were coming to the United States. There was not an exclusion of Middle Eastern Muslims from coming, because there was this mix of peoples that were coming. But at times there appears to have been certain kind of advantages for Muslims to kind of pass as Christians in particular nodes of this immigration circuit. And if we fast forward to get just a little bit of an introductory sense of how these immigration laws worked, when you fast forward to the 1920s and 30s, there was a kind of national pulling back against pulling back from that kind of openness to immigration, having new labor for industrialization. And until the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, there are some scientists who kind of naturalize as Americans from Germany, even from Egypt. Even in my own heritage, there are scientists who became American citizens in those days in the 1940s. But by the 1960s and 70s, you again have this turn back towards immigration. But in this newer iteration of immigration, the 1960s and 70s, you're getting a little bit of what was happening in the 40s and 50s, which was the trickle of scientists and this kind of brain drain of the 40s and 50s becomes a kind of an official policy in the 60s and 70s, where now universities across the United States are filling up with people coming for engineering degrees and science degrees and all kinds of... There's a new kind of official brain drain that is part of this immigration policy in the 60s and 70s, to have all these people from all around the world, India, China, Taiwan, elsewhere, Brazil, come to the United States, university students, and to pursue all these degrees in medicine. And this is where you begin to see a lot of doctors in the United States of diverse heritage, computer scientists, the whole tech scene. And in this case, it includes East Asian and South Asians. And so you see, while there were select people from the early 1900s who were of South Asian heritage, in many cases people who had come over as kind of experts British India, coming to the United States and maybe staying on, or in other cases, people who maybe worked in like the shipping industries who maybe stayed on, anything from people who are from regions of what is now like Afghanistan, Bangladesh. And we know in the early 1900s, many of them married and kind of disappeared into white communities and black communities. But by the late 1900s, these are much larger groups coming in, and they're becoming intertwined with this new American post-segregation language. You know, when there after the 1960s, with the overturning of a lot of these Jim Crow laws, which we'll talk about, and a lot of these post-emancipation segregation rules between black and white communities, which were obviously internally diverse by the 19, because you have in places like New York, you know, a lot of the self-identified African American or black communities included a lot of people from the Caribbean. Puerto Ricans were in some cases identified as white, in other cases identified as African American in the army. And because of so much of this is based on what people look like in the eyes of observers, by the late 1900s, these communities are now becoming part of this more officially diverse language of Indian Americans and Egyptian Americans and African Americans and Italian Americans and Irish Americans. And so the real story of modern multicultural diversity language in the United States really begins in the 1960s and 70s. But from another perspective, it actually has its origins in the late 1800s, when the government formalized the process of bringing in immigrants from all around the world, but especially Europe and the Middle East. And so I'll talk more about this in the next episode. And in the bonus episode, I'll get a little bit deeper into some of the legal dimensions, a little bit more of the kind of academic dimensions to all this, with a little bit more kind of chronology. So check us out in the next episode.